The bridge stands exactly 25 minutes walk from the last house of town. You have to take the path that winds round the edges of the field. Then, when the route splits, you take the track less travelled. Head towards the mountains in the east until you reach the river, then follow it upstream for about 10 or 11 more minutes. That's where it is. Beautiful and unassuming, a careful little stone structure built over the river. I discovered it for the first time in the summer, and I only found it by chance. It wasn't immediately obvious, the bridge. My dog, Bertie, was the one who actually led me there. I let him off the lead, and he made a beeline right in that direction. I had to rush after him when I became concerned he might tumble into the river. It was stupid of me, really. I haven't let him off leash anywhere dangerous since then, don't worry. But yeah, so that's when we found the bridge. Bertie spent a happy half hour sniffing all around it and wagging excitedly, though in the summer it isn't particularly remarkable. It leads over the river to a small clearing, pleasant enough, nice grass, a big tree. Some tumbled rocks where it borders the base of the closest hills. I don't know what else to tell you, really. It just leads to nowhere in particular. Probably why it's never used and no one knows it exists. But in the winter, something changes. Just under a week ago, I was walking Bertie down the same route. I'd opted, as I sometimes do, for the track less travelled, marvelling quietly at the mountains in the snow, when I felt Bertie tug at the leash. I looked down at him, and he looked back up at me, and he whined a little. I laughed. Silly dog, what do you want, huh? But it was clear what he wanted to do. He wanted to head back to his favourite bridge. All right, Bert, hell, let's do it. So I allowed him to lead us back down along the river, being careful to keep him on leash this time. Upon arrival, I could immediately tell that something was different. There was a certain sense in the air, an atmosphere that just felt off. So, despite Bertie's pleas, I decided to deny his pleas to go sniffing about. I don't recall what I thought exactly when I spotted the anomaly for the first time. The tracks, I mean. The footprints in the snow. I think my first thought was probably modest surprise that somebody actually knew the bridge existed. But the real bizarrety was the fact that the footprints only went halfway across. Regular, boot-shaped footprints leading up and out to the middle of the bridge. And there they just stopped. They just vanished as if the man was mid-step and then simply dissolved into thin air, into wintry mist. The thought made me shiver, but I didn't take it particularly seriously. Though Bertie was desperate to go and investigate, I held him back, and instead we went along our way. But I couldn't stop thinking about it. I just couldn't get those unnatural footsteps out of my head. Just let it go already, I tried to tell myself. This is so stupid. The guy probably double-backed on himself, or maybe the snow fell and covered up some of the prints. But both of these rationalizations failed to adequately explain what I saw. Did he just jump off, push himself up onto the side of the bridge in a single jump, and then leap right off? But why would he do that? Why would anyone do that? Maybe you get whisked away the second you reach the halfway mark. Whisked away to never return to some magical land. And so, a few days later, I find myself back at the bridge. More tracks, more footprints. Deer prints this time, by the look of them. And again, only halfway across to that empty, unassuming, snowy clearing beyond. And I know what you're thinking. You're wondering why I haven't crossed myself to check it out already, to see what would happen. And to be honest, it's because to do so is stupid. Why should I cross so I can see my footprints in the snow and push these intrusive daydreams aside? It's childish. I've no need to do such a thing. So naturally, my story begins a day later, right here at the foot of the bridge, preparing to cross. Bertie isn't with me this time. It's just me. Jacket open at the front and allowing in the chill. I could zip it up and save some warmth, but to do so would require me to take my hands out of my pockets. And to be honest, I can't really be bothered to do that right now. The snow-capped pine tree to my right sways gently in a sudden breeze, and I shiver, still stubbornly refusing to remove my hands from my pockets. Ahead, in the snow, are the prints of a fox. They patter round in a rough circle and then head to the bridge. My eyes follow them up, the little dents in the white. And sure enough, there they cease, at exactly halfway. Halfway. Only ever halfway. Well, we'll see what happens with mine, won't we? I say aloud to no one, my breath clouding as I take my first steps forwards. I keep to my pace, and I don't slow or turn back. Trudging forwards and crunching in the snow, my footprints deep and obvious. Drawing closer now, closer to the middle. My heart, to my confusion, starts to pound. But I don't slow down. I just keep moving forwards until I have crossed halfway. Head down, I watch my feet continue to make dutiful prints in the snow. Over the bridge, across the snow, I come to a quick stop at the other side of the embankment. There. Done. I did it. I sigh, with just a little disappointment. A part of me really wished that something was going to happen. Something. Anything. Something to add a little spark of wonder to my life. But even as I think these thoughts, I realize that something has changed. I have crossed the bridge, but looking back over it now, I see what appears to be the clearing on the opposite side. The clearing I should have crossed to. Yes, there's the big tree, the tumbling rocks and the edges of the hill, the mountains leading away beyond. I start in alarm as I see that my footprints only descend down the nearest half of the bridge. The opposite half is layered with entirely unbroken snow. What the hell? The footprints, my footprints, and incidentally, the footprints of the fox, carry on down towards me, but they lead from nowhere. No, I think to myself, no way. Turning around, I try to take in my surroundings. It wasn't immediately obvious that anything had changed, but now that I properly examine, I see that the landscape here is a complete mirror of the way it looked on the opposite side of the bridge. Still wintry, still layered in snow. The river is there, and the hills and mountains. But the trees are different, and they're all in different places. There are tracks through the snow that didn't exist before. Not possible. This is insane, I mutter to myself, bewildered. Hey, comes the sudden voice of a girl, not far from me either. I jump in surprise, and there stands the voice's source. A girl about my age, maybe a little younger, wrapped up in a teal blue woolen sweater and a grey thready scarf. She's standing by a small pine tree with one hand on the trunk, the other she brings up to a cautious, curious wave. She cocks her head, and her antlers tip to the side. Two prominent antlers, like a deer's, sprouting up from the top of her head. Jesus, I shout in alarm, turning at once and tripping in the snow, staggering back to the bridge. Hey, wait, she calls out, but I do not. I sprint right across, eyes forced closed by a sudden blast of icy breeze at the bridge's center before stumbling down to the bank of the other side. Damn, when did it get so dark? I look back behind me to see the original spectacle. On the opposite side is just an empty clearing. The clearing I was expecting to see. No girl, no mirrored world. And of course, my footprints only go halfway across the bridge. Just as it was before. I sprint all the way home and spend the evening in my room with Bertie, considering the things that I have seen. My fear, once I have time to process, quickly gives way to embarrassment. Then to frustrated curiosity, Why did I leave so quickly? She seemed nice. A nice girl. With antlers. As the night progresses, I struggle to get her out of my head. I end up doodling her in the corner of one of my notebooks. What if she's trapped? What if she needs help? The thoughts go round and around as the snow falls beyond the windows, and she dances through my dreams in the night. The second that the sun has risen on the next wintry morning, I have left the house, heading right back to the bridge with determination. Heart beating as I feel through me something unknown, something exhilarating. The excitement of a genuine adventure, perhaps. I realize as I walk that it's not something I've ever really felt before. Not in this, its purest form. The pines bristle quietly in the breeze, and the river runs slowly beneath the ice. When I approach the bridge, I see that the night's falling snow has entirely covered my old tracks, and the crossing looks untouched. I take a deep breath and slide on my gloves, then make my way down to it. "Don't chicken out, Stan," I tell myself. "You got this." Over the bridge I go, watching carefully this time, waiting for the exact moment of the change. I hit the halfway point, and that cold breeze forces me to squint and blink. And it's in these blinks that my surroundings are suddenly shifted. The view of the clearing ahead is lost, though I know now that I would still see its mirror image if I were to look behind me. In front of me is the shifted landscape, the new trees, the new tracks. And there, sitting on a branch in the tree this time, is the girl. The girl with the antlers and the teal blue sweater. We stare at each other for a moment. Then she waves at me and jumps down from the tree, landing with a nimble crunch in the snow. "Hey," she says, "it's you, isn't it? The boy from last time." Hey, I reply awkwardly, still not sure entirely how to react to her. So I came back to... Yeah, you came back. Real bad timing though. What were you thinking? She isn't smiling this time. I don't know how to respond. Look, come on, quick. Just get over here. She runs up to me and grabs my coat, dragging me down and away from the bridge. Hey, wait, just hold on. We have to go, all right? They're watching the bridge. But the sound of a sudden whistling whine, followed by a burst of flame in the snow to my right, cuts my question in half. Damn, I shout in alarm as a trail of fine cloud races through the air above our heads, finishing in a tree as that whistling whine catches up to it and bursts into a ball of fire, sending roasted pine needles raining down. The antlered girl drags me through the bushes, snow bursting in little clouds all around us as we push through, and she leads me across a nearby field. I turn to look behind me, wide-eyed, at the sight that meets me there. Unlawful entry of any organism into the Holy Mechanic territory. Surrender yourself at once, blares an angry mechanical voice. Stumbling past the trees and through the hedges come two tall and spindly beings made of a grim, dark metal. Plumes of thick black smoke are sent spiraling up and out from pipes and chimneys that adorn their bodies, that comprise their bodies, in an exoskeleton fashion. They grind and whir, and their necks extend out to disappear into disturbingly fish-looking heads. Made of a strange, charred metal though, of course. One of those metal monstrosities brings round an arm, and the tubes that connect its elbow to its body glisten bright in a sudden volcanic orange. I have to shield my face as a great breath of fire shivers from the creature's knuckles and torches the surrounding snow. I'm struck by a wave of warmth and turn back to face the way I'm going, running as fast as I can to keep up with the girl. "What the hell?" I shout at her, but she ignores me, instead skidding to a rapid stop. I stumble right past her and she grabs the cuff of my coat, dragging me suddenly sideways and down the edge of a steep bank, down towards the widening, iced-over river below. Down we go, then round corner after corner, our feet cracking the edges of the water's ice until the ground to our left levels out and she hauls me up into the snowy shrubbery at the base of the nearest mountain. It isn't until she's brought me into the relative safety of a shallow cave that she lets me go, and I stumble down onto my ass at once, trying to catch my breath as I push myself back against the cave wall, watching her warily. She watches me back, and we sit for a while, just us two, out of the cold and unsure of what to say. She eventually breaks the ice with, "You don't have any antlers." "No," I reply, "I don't." "So, how do you fight? Like, what do you use?" "Fight? Well, I don't really get into many fights, but with my hands, I guess." "Your hands?" "Yeah, you know, like my fists." She looks down at her own fists, as if considering. "Huh, weird. You must have really strong arms." I flush, then laugh awkwardly. Well, I mean, I guess." There's another pause. "Why did you come over the bridge at such a dumb time?" she asks me. "I don't even know how to answer that," I reply. "I just came over because I was intrigued. I didn't think anything was actually going to, you know, happen when I crossed." "Why did you run away the last time?" she asks. "I just got, I don't know, I wasn't sure what was happening. I wasn't as prepared yesterday as I was today." "Yesterday?" "Yeah, yesterday when I first came over the bridge." She shakes her head with a little half smile. "No, silly, it's been like 4 months. I try to comprehend this. 4 months? She nods vigorously. "Oh, right. 4 months. I peer out through the cave entrance to the snowy world beyond. "So, what the hell is going on? Where am I and, who are you exactly?" She leans suddenly close to me, and I stumble back up against the cave wall. Her eyes are large and brown, and she has a smattering of freckles across the bridge of her nose and her upper cheeks. "So, does anyone have antlers where you're from?" she asks. No, not really. Deer do, I guess, but I don't know if that's what you mean." "Deer?" she repeats, leaning back on her haunches. "Weird." She peeks out the cave entrance. "I think we're okay now. The machine folk don't tend to bother coming out this way. They just want to protect their holy site." I run a hand across my forehead. "Holy site. Look, could you just tell me your name?" I ask her. "Kalela," she replies, smiling. "You?" "Stan," I reply. "So, how come you were watching the bridge?" "Well, it's kind of my job to wait for animals that come through and help them get to safety." Her smile drops. "A person came through once, about a year ago, like you. No antlers either. He was one of the first creatures to cross the bridge after I took over the watcher role." Her mood changes and the atmosphere cools a little. "I wasn't fast enough to save him. I still think about him sometimes. He was a fully grown male, but the machine folk made an example of him. I failed him, and it's something I've worked really, really hard to never do again." "What did they do to him?" I ask quietly, and she sighs and looks away. "They strung him up, Stan, as a warning." I choose not to ask her to elaborate on this for now. The wind picks up outside, and the sound of its rumble grows steadily louder. "Come on," she says to me, taking my hand. She's warm. "I don't want us to get trapped here all day. Let me take you to our hideout." I nod, and she leads me back out and into the bluster. I look around for signs of machines, but seeing no evidence of their presence, I fall in step alongside Kalela, and together we trudge through the fields and the edges of the forest, beneath the gentle, watchful eyes of the mountains. She tells me about herself, about this side of the bridge. She's never been across to my side, apparently, and aside from the man she mentioned earlier, I think I might be the second human she's ever seen. She tells me about the machines, about how the bridge and its gate between the worlds is something that the machines supposedly made themselves long, long ago, and is now regarded by these metallic beings as something of a sacred site. The machines believe that the bridge continues to work due to its perfect balance between nature and machinery, the location of the trees and the angles at which the bridge looks out to the hills and mountains, all of critical importance. She scoffs a little when she says this, and I look across to her. The machine folk are hypocrites in her words. Outside of the sacred zone, wherever they go, they level and landscape and dig deep holes in the ground, pumping out fumes and bile, indifferent to the people who cross their paths at best, actively hostile at worst. If they really cared, then they wouldn't use those horrible flamers, she mutters, brushing some hair behind her ear. I catch a glimpse of a deep burn around her wrist as she does this, though she quickly tugs her sleeves back down. I tell her about my life back home too. I tell her how machines aren't people, but things that people use, and this is a concept she seems fascinated by. So they just do what you tell them to? She asks. How come? Because they have to, I reply. That's how they're designed. They don't think or anything. They don't think, she repeats. Yeah. Huh, she says, wrinkling her nose in thought. How do you know? I don't have an answer for this. I also tell her about my dog, Bertie. Her eyes light up at his mention, and I'm barraged with questions all about him. She doesn't recognize the word pet, but is happy to refer to him as my companion. I had a beast companion of my own once, she says excitedly. Her name was Aurelie, but I had to let her go off on her own once she got too big. I still see her sometimes, though, when she passes through. You let her go? What breed is she? Grey wolf, she chirps. I laugh nervously. Right, I see. Maybe I could meet Bertie someday, she asks. Well, yeah, why not? I guess I could bring him over sometime. You need to come through when the machines aren't taking part in their pilgrimage, though, okay? Otherwise, you'll have the same issue as you did today. I'm about to ask her to explain what she means by this, but as I open my mouth, we pass by a lone, high hill, and the air chills. The sun breaks only feebly through the thick snow clouds overhead, but the narrow beams of winter light that have made it through glint warningly against the totem atop the hill. I lift my gaze as its shadows passes across Kalela and I, and a wave of fear shivers down my spine in response. The totem atop the hill is comprised of a series of sharp, dark metal poles and scraps of metal, intricately woven to form the shape of a cross. Affixed to the cross is a black, flame-scorched skeleton. Its jaw hangs from one hinge, and its ribcage is stretched and cracked wide open. Sinner and trespasser are written on signs that hang from the cross's limbs. Kalela looks up at it with me, and she pauses for just a moment. She rubs her quick hand across her eyes and mutters something soft and quiet to herself under her breath before carrying on. She walks a little quicker than before, and the conversation dies with a mood. I struggle with a deep and foreboding paranoia as we leave the terrible shadow behind us and we continue on and into the haze. It's not much further, Kalela tells me as we pass into the forest. We've been walking for about 20 minutes since leaving the little cave, and her mood improved when I offered her some food I brought with me. Nothing special, just some store-bought cookies, but she'd enjoy them so much, I actually felt a little bad telling her that I didn't have any more to give her. I'm also not really sure what to expect of this hideout she mentioned. I'm kind of picturing a Robin Hood-esque roughed-up campsite strung up between some trees, a band of merry men, all with antlers, hanging out in the woods. The truth, however, is quite different. Damn, is all I can say when I first lay eyes on it, on the hideout. Here we are, says Kalela, and she spreads her arms. Before us, and nestled in the trees, are a series of narrow wooden houses. They lean into and against each other at unusual angles, but aside from this, they look remarkably stable, and indeed very livable. What I'm seeing is less a base camp and more an intricate little village. The inhabitants are antlered sure, but that's about all I got correct with my prediction. They are of all ages, and they stare at me as we pass them by. There are modest market stalls here, stone wells surrounded by leaves at their bases, and signposts grown into the trees. "Kalela," comes a gruff voice to our right. Kalela stops, and I do likewise, watching as a tall and white-set man puts down his tools and walks right over to us. He's massive, and his antlers go out further and wider than Kalela's do. "You're back early." "Hey, I did what I was supposed to do, Lurde," she retorts, pointing up at him. "Delane is heading out to cover the watch right now. And look, you see what I did? I brought back a boy from the other side. Safely. I saved him." The man she called Lurde looked down to me and raised an eyebrow. "Good," he says after a beat. "The machine folk have no respect for natural life. Every death in this valley is a stain on the spirit's own land." "It's, good to meet you," I say to him. "My name is Stan." "Hmm," he replies. "Stan, it's been a long time since someone has crossed over the bridge. You chose a less than opportune time to pass." Behind him, a group of antler children. I can't hear what they're saying, but one of them points to me, and the others gawk and stare. "I didn't know," I tell him. "I didn't know about any of this. It's different on the other side."
"Different and dangerous. I don't blame you seeking refuge on the spirit side, but as I said, your timing was inopportune."
Lurde turns and gestures to a group of his comrades. "Kalela, we're heading out to keep sights on the pilgrimage route. We would benefit from bringing along your human."
"Your human?" I repeat, but he ignores me.
"Lurde, I don't know. I'm kind of responsible for his safety now, and I was going to show him around."
"This wasn't a request. You're welcome to accompany us," he says.
Kalela looks like she's planning to say something else, then changes her mind and bites her tongue.
"Fine," she says, "but we're keeping him out of danger."
Lurde nods and he gestures us to follow. Our little group grows in size as we are joined by more of the antlered people. Each has something to say to me, and I talk with them all, till eventually we head off through the wooden village and the trees.
"This whole thing is crazy," I mutter to Kalela as we walk. "I'm still struggling to process that this is all happening, to be honest."
I don't tell her this, but I'm also finding it hard to stop thinking about the scorched skeleton, the one strung up on the cross with trespasser and sinner signs hanging down in warning. I need to get back, in all honesty. Lurde talked about my side being dangerous, but I know damn well which side I'd rather be on. I need to find a safe opportunity to get back. But also, I shoot a look over to Kalela. Also, I'm still curious about this world. That sense of adventure remains, and I don't want to be like I was yesterday, running away at the first sign of peculiarity. So, I stick it out for now. We pass by pine trees that are ringed with little lanterns, illuminating the gently drifting snow. "Like Christmas lights," I murmur out loud, which Kalela questions.
"You know," I say, "Christmas, Christmas lights."
"I don't know what that is," she replies.
"For real?"
"Ah, it's the best," I tell her. "Everyone's families get together and share gifts and have good food. Everywhere is all decorated in red and green or gold. Usually there's loads of lights."
"Lights? Like how?"
"Like electric lights. Artificial. I don't know how to explain it to you, but they're in all kinds of colours, and at night, when it's dark, they're hung up to form flashing and moving patterns around houses and on trees. It's beautiful, honestly."
She's fascinated by this. So I spend the rest of the walk telling her all about it, about all of our Christmas customs and events, and she gets more and more excited. A voice comes from her right as we walk. It's Lurde's, and to be honest, I'd kind of forgotten he was there.
"Don't get too attached, Kalela," he says in a low voice. "You know he'll have to go back."
He stops talking at once.
I get it, Lode. Whatever, she mutters after a moment. But our conversation is killed, pretty much stone dead.
The breeze blows. We approach the ridge of a hill, and the general volume of the group drops. The talking lowers to a general murmur, and the sound of their footprints is significantly dulled. Following the lead of those at the front, we crouch behind a series of large rocks, and Lode knocks my shoulder. I look at him, and he motions for me to follow him up to the front, where he points over the rocks and down to the ground below. See that? He says quietly. I take a look. Down there, in the valley between the hills and mountains, a dirt track has been ground into the earth and melted away all the snow. It winds its way through the hills, and making their gradual way along it are a series of shambling beings. The machines, it's plain to see. One of them looks just the same as the beings that attacked Kalela and I this morning. Another is of a similar height, but has no legs, instead churning up the snow and grass beneath caterpillar tracks. Great plumes of dark smoke leak from pipes across his shoulders, as it does from the others. The third is far larger, a shuffling behemoth that moves on four large metallic legs. If I focus, I can hear its engine whirring from all the way up here, as it churns out those tarry black clouds. If I look to the right, I can see more trails of smoke slowly approaching from behind the hills. More machines, perhaps. Some of the group retrieve makeshift journals from their packs and begin making notes in a language I can't read, noting the angle of shadows of certain rocks with little sketches. I turn to Lode. Where are they going? I ask him. They're all making their way to the bridge. There'll be dozens upon dozens more over the next few weeks. We got word the other day about a small farm out in the east, completely leveled by the machine folk to make way for a rest stop. He scratches his jaw. Three killed, no remorse, corpses left for the birds.
Rest stop? I reply. I don't get it. Why would a machine need to rest?
Everyone needs to stop sometimes, Stan. Can't keep walking indefinitely.
Kalela chimes in. But that's the whole point of a machine, isn't it? To just keep going until it breaks down? Maybe it's just a repair center or something that they've built?
Lode doesn't seem to understand. What abomination they've built in place of the farm is not hugely relevant. He reaches out for my shoulder. Stan, a female human came across that bridge once, you know, decades ago now. I was only a very young man myself, but she was able to help us. She was able to tell us things of the machines. She told us they would likely fail if knocked into water, and for the most part, she has proved correct. I can't tell you how many lives we've been able to save with her information. He looks out across the plains at the shambling machines. But it's not enough, and the machine folk have changed somewhat since then. I don't know what it's like on your side, but by all accounts, your dealings with these beings are numerous and deadly. It must be difficult fighting back without even any antlers to protect yourself. The wind rustles the collar of my jacket, and Kalela pulls a scarf a little tighter around her neck. Stan, says Lode, it's your turn now, if you would help us. Take a look at these creatures. Is there anything you can think to suggest to help us here? The more machine folk come through, the greater the threat, and this is our most threatened time of year. What do you say? Will you help? Kalela looks at me. And hell, what can I say but yes? I nod and reply that I will. I'll try, I tell them, and a great general sense of goodwill and thanks spreads out across the group. So we spend the rest of the day observing the machines as they trundle through the valley, all on their way to the bridge. They may well respect the locations of the trees and rocks that surround the bridge, as Kalela tells me they do, but out here they seem to care little for the environment. The largest of the machines that day, a massive, hulking ogre of metal, thuds past the tall, thin tree on its route, and its pipes catch in the branches. Instead of using effort to untangle itself, the machine instead just plods onwards, using a great hand to bring the entire tree down with a crash into the snow, rather than stop or adjust its course. The rumble of its fall echoes across the hills. They share their food with me,
and I tell them stories about my side. They seem fascinated by the concepts of cars and even basic electrical appliances, but they struggle to consider them as anything other than threats. "So, cars aren't dangerous?" one of the people asks me. "Do they ever kill people?" "Well, I pause for thought. "Not intentional. It's human error mostly. You blame yourselves for the deaths they cause. It's complicated." Kalayla just wants me to talk about Christmas. I tell her about mulled wine and Christmas desserts, about Christmas music and bells and holly and all that good stuff. And she seems enthralled by it. I can already see the cogs turning in her head, wondering if she can emulate it here in her little village. "I could show you how to make a wreath if you want," I grin at her, and she grins right back with excitement. "I would love that." "Shh," Lurde grumbles. "Not so loud." "Sorry," she whispers, looking at me and smiling. But all the while, the gears in my own head are turning too. I'm trying to think of a plan I can use to help these people. The image of the man who came before me, the black charred and broken skeleton on the cross. It's one that refuses to dissipate, and I can't help but wonder if any of their own have suffered such fate at the metallic hands of the machines. It's nightfall back at the camp by the time we return. We didn't just stay on that hilltop all day either. We also trekked around and followed the route back a little. We tried to get a vantage point of the leveled farm, but all we could see was ash and smoke. Lurde didn't feel happy taking Kalayla and myself any closer, not on the first outing. "It's late," I say as the moon rises in the sky. "I should really get back." "Do you have to get back tonight?" Kalayla asks me. "You can stay here, you know, if you want." "Time passes differently on either side," Lurde says as he sits back in his chair by the fire. "I don't know if we'd see you again if you were to return tonight. Tell me, what do you have for us on the machine folk? Do we know these creatures remind you of the creatures from your home?" "Yeah," Kalayla says to me, the orange lights of the fire bright in her eyes. "Do you have a plan?" I pause, heart beating, as I look back into her eyes. She smiles, and I look away, embarrassed. "Actually, yeah, I think I do." The embers drift through the air, and the antlered folk around the fire lean in. "So, Kalayla, you mentioned something to me this morning. You said that the machines dig deep holes in the ground. Is that right?" She nods, and there's a general murmur of agreement through the gathering. "Do you know what that is?" "We have our theories, but we're not sure, no." "Okay," I continue. "And Lurde, these machines, the bridge is a holy site, right? They make a pilgrimage to come here." "Yes." "So they come from all around then. Pilgrims can travel halfway across the world if they want to. These machines, some of them must come from really far away." I tried to gather my thoughts, express myself as best as possible. "We all see the smoke they produce, right? The thick black clouds that spiral out from their bodies. I mean, they're running on some kind of fuel. They're burning it, combusting, like engines do. And I don't see them ever carrying any bags or pulling carts. They must be topping up somewhere on their pilgrimage, or they'd never make it the whole way round." "Fuel?" one of the folks asked me. "Like wood, you mean?" "I guess, but it's like something that'll last longer. Coal or oil." I struggle for a few minutes trying to explain the concept of fossil fuels to them, but eventually I bring the conversation back to the holes in the ground. "These holes, I bet they're mines. That makes the most sense. They'll be mining for coal or oil or whatever to feed the pilgrims. I bet that's what they've done to the farm too." "Mines?" Lurde repeats. "Energy wells." "Yeah, I guess." "Stan, will you stay? Stay for one more night and help us turn your ideas into a clear plan." I hesitate. Will my parents miss me for a night or two? "Sure," I reply. "I'll stay." Kalayla wraps me in a hug, and I try to laugh it off. I sleep that night in a spare room, listening to the sounds of the forest and the sounds of Kalayla humming through the wooden wall. And that next morning, I'm up and awake, looking over a series of maps. The known holes, or mines as they've started referring to them as, are marked in certain locations, and raiding parties are set up. "There's only two confirmed in this entire region," says Lurde. "Three if you count the demolished farm, and it's likely on the new construction mine." "If they finish it," I say out loud, "then more machines would come through. Why wouldn't they?" "So we destroy them," says Lurde. There's a rustle of dissent. "Lurde," says one of the antlered women, "destruction is not to be dealt out carelessly. The machine folk destroy, and the machine folk are inherently damaged and cruel. They suffer because of their curse, and bring that same suffering to our doorsteps." "To destroy goes against the plan of the spirits," says another. "I cannot break a thing that was made, even if by those wretched machines." "You fools," muttered another. "The machine folk are unnatural. We cannot live and let live. They mean to destroy us. They hunt us, and if they had their way, they'd wipe us all out of the face of the planet." "I can hunt a machine that enters into our realm," says another. "If I'm threatened, I'll strike, but to go out and bring down something a sentient being has built, has created, I don't know if I can." Lurde just shakes his head. "If I'm said to be cursed, then so be it. This human boy has joined our ranks, and I won't let this opportunity slip us by. I cannot wait for the wisdom of the next passing traveller in 10 or 20 or 40 years' time." I step forwards. "I'm not afraid of any curse. I doubt it'll affect me anyway. Machines are different from where I'm from, so I'll help you destroy them." A little further deliberation, and that's all it takes. Armed with axes and saws, and split into smaller groups of the willing and the persuaded, we head out into the wilds. Following the maps to the locations of the mines, I've never in my life felt so elated. To be part of a mission with a real, impactful purpose, and one with a threat of real danger too. As foolish as it seems, the threat is exhilarating. It sharpens and clears my mind like nothing I've ever experienced. Kalayla is with a group. She wanted to come, and I told Lurde I wouldn't go without her. Across the field we trek, avoiding the paths of the trundling, grinding machines and the trails of smoke and leaking fluid. I've been given a white-green sweater interwoven with leaves and twigs, and we hide ourselves at the edge of the machine's outpost. Ahead lies, as described, a huge hole in the ground, surrounded by dark metal gridwork, caterpillar track gears and grinding cranes. Smoke pours from the cracks in the ground, and the snow is all melted down there below. "You know the plan," Lurde mutters, and we nod, then split into groups. My heart pounds as I crawl across the edge of the hill through the undergrowth, the few surviving winter thorns scratching at my hands as I move. "This is insane," I think to myself. "What am I doing? Why did I allow myself to get roped into this madness?" "Because you wanted to be," comes the simple response. "And hell, it's right." Down below the chunter, a series of machines, roughly humanoid, though with long, rusted limbs. They creak and crunch as they move across the rough dirt ground, overseeing the transfer of metal materials. Materials being moved across a series of narrow tracks in smallish carts. The carts spark and whir as they pass over the iron rails, and some disappear into holes in the side of the nearest mountain. Kalayla, Lurde and I set to work on the selected tree. An enormous, reddish-brown pine that strikes way up towards the sky. Lurde determines the angle to carve at it, and then we simply sit and wait for the wind to rise. 2 hours it takes before Lurde determines the wind loud enough for us to begin. 2 long, wintry hours. We take turns to strike at the tree, carving out a groove on the side we want it to fall. We use saws too, carving out this chunk of tree in preparation. Once the chunk is fully cut from the wood, and already with arms aching, we start sawing away at the opposite side. It takes a long time, and I lose count of the number of frantic glances I make down to the mine below. But after a while, we have cut our way through the bulk of the tree. The sound of a high, shrill bird whistles across the valley and the ground. Says Lurde. "The others are ready. They're just waiting on us now." Just waiting on us. so close to success, and it's here that our luck runs out. I don't know if it's me or Kalayla, or just freak chance, but with our final strike of the saw, an enormous creak groans out from the tree and ripples all the way up the trunk. In time, perfectly, to a sudden drop in the wind. We freeze, and I shoot a sideways look down to the mine, to see two of the machines looking back up at us.
"Alert," blares the sirenoid voice. "Organisms present to the facility. React accordingly."
"Damn," I shout in alarm, and panic sets in. The machines lurch into terrifying activity, grinding and creaking as they throw themselves up against the rock below and begin to clamber up towards us, their black eyes shining with malice. A warning horn blares from the mine, and Lurde looks back at us.
"Keep going," he shouts. "Just keep soaring. Bring this thing down. That's more than signal enough. Go."
And he takes off down the side of the snowbank, snow spraying up as he lands with a crunch on the head of the nearest machine. There's a rattling of gears as cogs and oil are sent spilt out over the snow and stone, and the other machine alters its course. Flames burst from one of its pipes and are sent spraying out in a wide arc. I grab Kalayla and bring her down to the ground as they pass by over our heads, and we feel the rush of heat.
"Come on," I tell her, "we finished the job."
"Right," she replies, grabbing her end of the saw, and feverishly we work to bring the tree down. It creaks and wavers, crackling as it slowly starts to break away at our cutting. And, at last, we break clean through, and with an ear-splitting crunch, the tree begins to tip. It tips in just the direction we'd set it to, and the air seems to vibrate as the monstrous pine comes tumbling down.
"Watch out,"
we call out into the chaos, pulling back at a burst of flames, and the colossal tree crashes hard into the metalwork of the mine. The second it connects, another similarly sized tree starts to fall too from the valley's opposite side, and it falls down hard, hammering into the metal grids and cranes. The first causes real damage, and great clouds of smoke and ash are sent billowing up and into the atmosphere. And the second impact is greater still. It smashes up the rail network and strikes the side of the mountain, sending enormous rocks and boulders tumbling down right into the hole. An avalanche of them, really. A great orange flash bursts from the ground, and the mine begins to collapse in on itself, taking a great deal of equipment along with it. "Lurde," Kalayla calls, suddenly throwing herself down onto her stomach and putting out an arm. Below us is the man himself, covered in ash and clambering back up the rock. I hold onto Kalayla, and together we help to pull him back up onto the embankment.
"Great," he grins,
and I can't help grinning too.
"Now, let's get ourselves out of here."
"Thank you for your sacrifice," Kalayla murmurs to the fallen tree, and she takes a moment to rub some snowy soil across the exposed trunk we've left behind. We regroup the others in our little team, and we race right back up to the base camp, careful to take a route we know won't be followed, and I'm riding the high for the rest of the day. It's all that we can talk about, and when the others rejoin us to share that they too were successful, I'm caught up in something of a celebration. I've never felt such a sense of community, of shared experience in my entire life. It's addicting. But I can't stay here forever. I just can't. So, the next morning, I tell them all it's time for me to go. Kalayla is particularly upset, and it hurts, but I gotta go.
"Thank you for your help, Stan," says Lurde. "You're a fine young warrior."
I beam in response. He insists on accompanying me back to the bridge. The patrols and the watchers haven't spotted a single machine heading towards the bridge so far this morning, so we feel relatively safe. Kalayla comes too. Delena and the others have been covering my shift for long enough. It's time I get back to my post anyway. She shrugs. But there is an emotion in her voice. I can hear it. We walk as a trio through the snow. Though it's not as thick as it was yesterday, or the day before. There's been no new snowfall for a while. We're taking a slightly different route to the one we left from, Kalayla and I. But it isn't long before I start to recognize where we are. "You know, I'm really grateful you allowed me to," I begin. But Lurde puts out a sudden warning hand and stops. Something's wrong, he mutters. And squinting, I can see a figure that might well be Delana waving frantically at us from a branch up high in a tree. Then, in the very next second, a great arc of flame comes bursting from the bushes ahead, torching the nearby hedges and sending us jumping for our lives. One lone machine stumbles through the undergrowth and swings round its arm. Its head sparks and fizzles. Trespassers, trespassers from beyond the sight. And for the second time, Lurde takes it upon himself to be the distraction. Go, he shouts to me. Kalela, get him to the bridge. And he ducks and dodges as the machine approaches, avoiding a blast of fire and then ramming his horns into the machine's side, sending nuts and screws raining down into the snow. Come on, Kalela cries out, grabbing my hand and dragging me towards the bridge. An exact mirror of how she welcomed me in. We race past the scorched bushes and past the trees and rocks. But as the bridge comes at last into view, I see that it's different. Oh, I mutter, then, oh no. The snow across and around the bridge has been largely melted. It's clear to see, based on the burned branches and damaged bushes, exactly where the flame was wielded, and the bridge before me is nothing but a water-soaked stone. Kalela stares at it, then tries to speak. Stan, oh no, I'm sorry, but it's not going to work. I try anyway. I run to the bridge and attempt to cross it, and of course, I am able to do so. But my shoes tap against the stone, and when I reach the other side, when I reach the clearing, I'm still standing in it. If I turn around and can see Kalela still there on the opposite side, flashes of fire and bursts of smoke escape up into the air behind her through the trees. I rush back across the bridge and try again, then again. But without the snow, it would seem, it leads to nowhere but the clearing. It's just a bridge. Lurde escaped with some bruises and burns, but he apparently always does, and Claire and I simply return to the village. I panicked a bit at first, trying to work out if the time that passed over here was inverse to the time that passed over there, struggling to work out the mathematics of it all. But I came to the conclusion that a couple of days spent on Kalila's side of the bridge was still only a few hours back home, or something like that. And whilst I couldn't prove it, it was enough to keep me calm at first. I spent my days with Kalela, waiting for the snow to fall sufficiently to heal the bridge. But for almost 2 weeks, it scarcely snowed at all. I just became ingrained with the community. The destruction of the mines had a hugely positive impact on the region. Next, the no new machines came through, though Lurde remained pessimistic, or realistic in his words. He knows eventually they'll be back, the machines, but for now, there is peace. I helped the group bring down that horrible metal cross, the totem atop the hill, with the scorched skeleton. We bury the bones, and good words are said at the ceremony. The days go quickly, and the weeks blur into months. The snow does fall again, but I'm no longer in any desperate rush to get home. After all, I ended up falling for Kalela. I'm sure that doesn't surprise you, given the way I've spoken about her. And what can I say? She's amazing. She loves me back, by the way, even though I don't have any antlers. The months pass by, but I can't help feeling painful memories of home, of my house, my friends, my family, of Bertie. It's these thoughts that build and grow inside me. They lead to conversations with Kalela, and these conversations in my head lead to discussion about taking her back with me, just for a quick visit. Maybe I could bring Bertie back here with me, and then she'd finally get to meet him. She is skeptical at first, scared too, as she was raised on stories of the terrible, dangerous machines on my side of the bridge. But I'm able to convince her to give it a try. I remind that surely only a day or two has passed my side, and that it's almost Christmas. I get to take her to a real Christmas market. You'll get to see the lights. I can't wait to show you. And my family will love you, I promise. They won't care about your antlers. I'll make sure of it. Oh my goodness, she replies, grinning, as we run through the snow, hand in hand. This is crazy. I can't believe I'm going to cross the bridge. Her breath clouds around her mouth, and she says it again. I'm going to cross over the bridge. I laugh, though
though we quieten down as we approach, careful not to get ambushed in the same manner as last time. But there are no machines here now, and ahead through the bushes there lies the bridge, covered in snow and awaiting our arrival. I look at her and she looks back at me. "Are you ready?" I ask softly, and she smiles. "Let's do this." I grin at her with a rush of emotion, and together we run towards the bridge. The breeze rises as we step down into the snow, and looking past my feet as we run, I catch sight of a set of prints below me, right there in the snow. They look like rabbits. The rabbit prints lead up to the center of the bridge, across the middle and through the snow, and then down the opposite side, and into the clearing beyond. Hell, I can see it. I can see the rabbit that made the prints on the opposite side, watching us both with his head cocked. We're moving too quickly for me to process all this, of what it implies. But as we reach the halfway point and the breeze whistles past my ears, Kalila's laugh is suddenly lost in the wind. In one moment, I'm holding tight to her hand, and the next, I'm gripping nothing but air. My view changes ahead. I trip and stumble down the bridge like an idiot, slipping and crashing down on the stone and landing with a grunt. In the grass. Just grass, no snow. "Kalila," I call out, breathing hard. But she's not there. I'm back to where I started, all those many months ago. This is the bridge. There, on the opposite side, is the clearing. But I can hear the gentle rush of river. It isn't frozen now. There is no ice. The snow has melted, and all that's left of it sits in graying clumps in the shadows of the trees. The bridge is just stone. There's no snow on it at all. "No," I murmur, suddenly panicking. "No, no, no." And I stagger to my feet. I try running over the bridge. But nothing happens. I cross forwards and backwards, and again and again and again, as the sun sinks in the sky, then sets. And still I cross, but nothing happens. Nothing happens, and I'm all alone. She's gone. My parents greet me with shock and concern, though Bertie is absolutely beside himself with joy when I stumble through the front door. He sleeps in my room with me, but I scarcely get any sleep at all. I just watch out the window and wait for snow. I do that a lot these days, waiting for snow that never falls. The days go by, and still, nothing. Weeks. Christmas comes and goes. Months roll by. We enter into spring, then summer. And she's all I can think about. The girl I left behind, on the opposite side of the bridge. I still go there, you know, with Bertie. I like to sit on the bridge's stone, and imagine she's sitting on the opposite side with me. But I will wait. I'll wait for winter. And no matter how long it takes, I will see her again.